This is the Blueprint Podcast, bringing you the latest in cyber defense and security operations from top Blue Team leaders. Blueprint is brought to you by the SANS Institute and is hosted by SANS Senior Instructor John Hubbard. And now, here's your host, John Hubbard.
Coming up on this episode of Blueprint, if you're someone looking to get into cybersecurity, already in InfoSec and looking to stay current, or an organization looking to hire new cybersecurity positions or upskill your current employees, this episode is for you. Stick around for a discussion all about building and measuring cybersecurity skills with guest Rob Lee on this episode of Blueprint. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of Blueprint, where we've got none other than Rob Lee, a guy who's been around SANS for a long time as an author, as a DFIR curriculum instructor, and now chief curriculum director for the whole of the SANS Institute. Today, we're here to cover one of the things I think Rob probably in an outstanding position to be an expert on at this point, and that is cyber reskilling. Something that a lot of organizations are looking to do, a lot of people are looking to do on a personal level, and as threats continue to grow and we continue to see more and more damage over the year, this is something that's only going to grow in relevance. So, Rob, first off, welcome to the podcast. And for those who might not know you, let's hear a little bit about your background and your current position.
Hey, thanks, John. First of all, really excited to be here on the Blueprint. I've really put together an amazing show and the interviews you've done over the past couple of years. They've just been top-notch. I really feel flattered to finally make the cut. You know, a little bit about my background. I feel like I've been doing this for a long freaking time. Since 96, I was in the Air Force, worked in one of the first intrusion section squadrons, now defunct 609th Information Warfare Squadron, but maybe arguably be the first information operations cyber unit that was deployed by a military. I had no idea what I was doing. I was one of those that, the SANS Institute really wasn't in, existence at that point. So you really had to, self-train almost in everything. The Practical Unix and Internet Security Guide, that book, I think everyone had at that time frame, was the only thing in existence. And we were using, at the time, was NetRanger product to do intrusion detection. Quickly moved from there and started working with the Air Force also special investigations, doing national level computer intrusion investigations, going back to even our cyber threat intelligence course here at SANS, it makes mention of it. Moonlight Maze was one of the first instances of nation state attackers that kind of cropped up back in 1998. And kind of the ball just kept rolling from that point that, I never thought I'd be making a career out of cybersecurity. But background includes being a SOC analyst, doing intrusion investigations, digital forensics work. I worked in offensive operations, Title 10, Title 50 for the U.S. government, did vulnerability research, non-public exploit development, went back to Mandiant, did instant response, did management there, got my MBA, started my own company. And all along, I also worked at the SANS Institute developing what eventually became their forensics curriculum, initially based on their first course that we had at SANS, Track 8, which became 508. And then slowly just, things took off from there. I think like you, I am very fortunate to be doing what I love on a daily basis. I love what's going on, seeing what's going on in the world with cybersecurity in terms of, the level of, people really saying how important it is at this point. Whereas, not even 10, 15 years ago, was it like almost an afterthought? I was like, yeah, we kind of need it. But today, most organizations, are really taking this seriously. And it's become something that, for a lot of us in the field, started way back then. Something that, there's so many different niche areas to be in. It's, the fact I've experienced in multiple fields is rather unique. I don't think we're going to see many people kind of follow that same path where you kind of like jump in across the board. You probably, be more niche almost immediately in a lot of your, hey, I'm a blue team person, but, maybe you get into the hacker exploits, but, you typically red teamer, you love the red team stuff. If you like the cloud, and so forth, that the skill sets needed for one discipline are so immense that, you have some basics that are covered, but, something you really have to think about is, a lot of people are just entering the field.
Yeah, I have to imagine way, way more just subspecialties now than there ever have been in this. So talking reskilling, right, that can come in a number of forms, and we'll get to that when we get there. But to kind of kick off this conversation, what brings you to kind of be interested in the reskilling topic, and what are you seeing in terms of like the state of the industry and the need for reskilling right about now?
Well, nothing. That's a great question. You know, the thing that changed and has changed rather significantly over the past 3 years was the onset of COVID. And to a great extent, it forced a lot of organizations to transition more quickly and rapidly into diversification of capabilities in their own workforce, in addition to what they need for their enterprises to succeed. Prior to COVID, you know, it's pretty typical that you'd house your own IT resources in a building and a co-location, maybe in the basement, that is, you know. But again, once the remote workforce really, you know, happened, you ended up moving a lot of that infrastructure into the cloud over the past 2 years, where, you know, how are we going to get access to, you know, basic services, you know, Zoom as a software as a service. You know, most people will be using their own personal PCs or even a work PC, not even, you know, connecting to a work environment. So what's the perimeter at this point? What are you defending? What are you looking at? And, you know, the attack surface has blown up as a result of this, because what we were used to, you know, defense of the island and be able to monitor and get, you know, regular traffic patterns has really shifted. You know, you really had to think about host protection, cloud-based protection, how do we do forensics and its response on these, you know, basically services, you know, like O365, where most organizations have transitioned over into hosting their own exchange to hosting it in the cloud. You know, not only because it's cheaper, it's more efficient, you know, for a lot of organizations. But what does that mean, you know, for cybersecurity as a whole? So there's this technological change that occurred that has basically been moving behind the scenes, you know, as a lot of people have been looking at this from their own skill sets.
Yeah. So with that as a background, what does reskilling mean to you? Is that something of getting deeper into the stuff that's changed, or is that moving careers, a little bit of all the above? What is the under the umbrella of reskilling in your mind?
Well, I don't even know. You know, you asked earlier before we started, you know, is reskilling the right word? I don't know. I'm just kind of using it right now, you know, almost making the analogy that I think cybersecurity is about to undergo a transition, not much different than the transition from typewriters to word processors, is that the reskilling that we'll need to have happen is you need a retraining and reskilling of a lot of your workforce. Either A, you're faced with the, hey, maybe we should hire the, you know, young new kid who may have these skills, or B, I have to go take someone who's been with my company well, knows the company well, and I need to give them additional skills in order for them to be able to complete their jobs. So where this initially came up, and I remember, you know, and I'll just, you know, talk about even at Sam's a little bit, is that, you know, cloud, for example, you know, we have a cloud curriculum and we were looking for more cloud instructors. I said, well, we have, you know, 150 instructors at SANS. I said, you know, I wonder how many of them have, you know, deep knowledge cloud experience. And, you know, I was looking at that and what we found is that, you know, we obviously have a lot, but, you know, it's far, you know, from the, well, everyone knows TCP/IP, you know, it's like, that's almost like a core fundamental skill. You have to do that. But today, will you need to know those fundamental skills, or is it more the fundamentals are changing? Do you need to understand cloud infrastructure a lot sooner and have that as the base? And how do you get that exposure if you've been working in the field for 15 years? You know, do you need to go back and say, okay, I need cloud basics and admit, hey, I'm a master of this. And, you know, do I need to go back to a basic course just to reintroduce myself to the new laws of physics? It's almost like retraining new medical techniques that come forward. It's like 20 years as a doctor, sooner or later, you need to go back to training and how to do, you know, the current surgery techniques and, you know, potentially practice on that, you know, and be able to, you know, have the confidence that your patients are going to look to you and say, yeah, okay, you know, the old doctor is able to still do the new operations. So that's where that thinking came from. And it was mostly through discussions with SANS instructors. I started thinking, oh, maybe we need as a whole, and I, you know, not just in SANS, but outside, I start talking to other organizations that there's a real fear that a lot of their current workforce, you know, what core skills do they now need? And, you know, can you go to someone who's been in the field for 15 years or plus saying, hey, we need you to go take a cloud essentials course. And they're like, well, you know, and I could pick up a book, you know, maybe they're kind of like, you know, you and I, when we first started, but maybe it's the easiest path is to say, hey, listen, we're going to, you know, put you back into a basic program just to bring you up. And then are there multiple sub niches inside cloud even at this point, you know, that we're looking at. What is the perimeter now? What is a SOC monitoring? You know, how is it shifted from network to host-based and to cloud-based and software as a service? You know, these are some of the things, like the entire restructure of operations may change too. And I think a lot of that's going to come out specifically from a retraining effort where we have a lot of people saying, hey, the thing we used to do, we now need to do this new thing because you now have the skill sets to be able to do that.
Yeah, undoubtedly. It's a change game when we have gone from, you know, not really anything in the cloud to now everything is in the cloud, and we have these multiple levels of abstraction, and we have different architectures. We got zero trust we're trying to, you know, turn things into, and you know, SASE, whatever kind of architectures, and just very different stuff than what we had before. There's, I think, more things to learn and different levels of abstraction to learn that on. Whereas before, like you said, you know, it might be TCP/IP basics and core fundamentals there. Now we might be diving into, you know, serverless architecture. How do we defend that, right? That wasn't a thing a couple of years ago. And so just all of these things definitely in my mind lead up to, we need a lot new skills and to keep people current with all of those. If you look at some of the surveys that are out there, the IC Squared has one, the Global Information Security Workforce Study they put out every year is one to check out. And they're always saying, like, you know, millions of IT security workers are needed, you know, worldwide.
Yeah.
And like 50% of teams are hiring. And, you know, they have a nice breakdown of what skills people are needed on. And it's all cybersecurity, you know, related stuff, but it's those technical skills and cloud skills and everything else. It's an interesting spot to be in, and clearly a growing one. Way I wanted to break this down is the kind of a couple different facets to this question, reskilling, right? There's reskilling from I'm already working in security and I want to continue to work in security and keep myself current. And maybe we start there, but the other two kind of things I wanted to cover after that are I'm not in security and I want to get into security. And then from the organizational perspective, what do I do as an organization that wants to bring people in that are maybe already employees and reskill them to be a cybersecurity practitioner.
So, right.
Starting with the first one, right? Keeping yourself current as someone that's out there. How does someone know where do you get the training? Like what can you advise people who are maybe already in the field to do to look at, you know, am I current? What can I learn and where can I go to learn that stuff?
Well, it's the same question I ask you. It's like, what scares you? What would keep you up at night saying, man, I hope I don't get called about on this tomorrow? Or, you know, you're teaching a class. If someone asks this question, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to answer it. But it actually comes down in two sides of that. It's a technological awareness of the new platforms that exist. But it's also the second side of that is aware of attacker techniques that are currently in use and being practiced. You know, from an example of, you know, how's ransomware, you know, actually being accomplished today, you know, the different groups out there moving inside the organizations. Is it just strictly through email? Is it through exposed, you know, services? You know, how much of that is actually at risk? And, you know, what do you do to mitigate that? Even, you know, being held for, you know, huge sums of money. And, you know, just that alone, you know, what are the different attack groups doing and how are they potentially penetrating in the organizations? And that's where I always recommend, you know, like offensive courses that are really being kept up to date. You know, you have to look for, is cloud involved? You know, is, you know, from these services, service attack side, and then the technology base of that. So both of those combined into a single, which one of these is going to be more useful to you for being able to keep up with the trends? So ransomware is a really good example. Is that, you know, like that stuff does keep a lot of organizations, you know, square, but how many organizations really feel that they are able to respond well to a ransomware attack? Have you tabletopped it? Have you worked through all the different, you know, features? Would you pay the ransom? And then do you have a confidence in your team that if you don't pay the ransom, you're still going to be able to recover? You know, your traditional skills may not cover those. And that's where you follow through with a gap analysis a little bit, and, you know, from a, you know, personal one saying, I don't know what I would do if all of a sudden the ransomware hit this particular type of system. And it's one of the reasons why you take a look at Linux security, Unix security, whereas, you know, there's this trend, you know, it was like everyone had to know it in the early 90s and mid 90s, and, you know, kind of trailed off into the early 2000s where Windows and Windows Enterprise networks became the, you know, primary dominant form of enterprise technologies. But guess what's now making a comeback? Well, Linux and Unix. Why? Well, it was because of so many of the infrastructure-based cloud systems are all based off of Unix and Linux. You know, obviously platform being free and so forth, but you have a lot of people who haven't seen that before. And so there's like, what do I do to secure it? What do I do to make sure my data is in the right locations? You know, what are the vulnerabilities? You know, what about the web servers? You know, all the things, you know, you end up running into this, what is old is new again. And, you know, do you have a Linux class to, you know, go to, you know, to be able to not only how do you defend these systems in the cloud, but how do you potentially respond to them as well with this different technology base that you're not used to?
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you're enjoying this episode, then you're undoubtedly interested in building the strongest security operations team that you can. For those who want to go even deeper, did you know that SANS has not one, but two courses that cover security operations centers as well? For the leaders, managers, and directors out there, my co-author Mark Orlando and I offer 551, Building and Leading Security Operations Centers. This course covers building your team, your physical and virtual workspace, getting the right data into your tools, and then focusing on security priorities through everyday execution of important security tasks and building the best SOC team possible. For the technical practitioners out there, my course Sec 450, Blue Team Fundamentals, Security Operations and Analysis is designed to cover everything you need to jump in being the best SOC analyst that you can be. We cover important data types, SOC tools, security logs, malware, analysis technique, automation, and much, much more. In addition, if you want to prove you can deliver the best on any security team, both courses have an accompanying certification available from GIAC. That's the GSOM for 551 and the GSOC for 450. Check out both courses and free demos available on the SANS website. You can get registered today for an in-person course at one of our many events, or go to On Demand and take either class anywhere at your own pace. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, it's funny. Two of the things you mentioned there, two things I hit every single time I teach, no matter what it is, right? Class-wise, I always wrench in like the fact that learning offense as a defender is really important. And I'd speak from, you know, my experience as a SANS student originally, right? I took 560 with Ed Skotis way back in, I don't know when it was, 2014, I think it was. And came back from that class like, wow, I'm going to defend very differently now because I know what's possible from an attacker perspective. And you can, you know, play your whole, you know, career in the defensive pool. But if you don't kind of flip sides at least once and see and look over an attacker's shoulder or take a class on it, I think there's a lot that you might miss. So that's super important. The other thing, techniques for ransomware and stuff like that, that's another thing. I actually just doubled down on that kind of content in some of the classes, pointing out things like when the Conti playbook leaked back, I think it was last December.
Yeah.
That's like a beautiful thing to say, like, here is literally what your attackers are typing. So if any of the listeners haven't seen that, just search Conti playbook leak and you'll find it. But yeah. It was all the files, it was all the commands, it was how they do it, you know, TTPs galore. And as a defender, I always emphasize, like, that's the kind of thing you have to pay a lot of attention to, because if you don't know what you're seeing in there, it's going to hit you and you're not going to know it until it's too late. So, yeah.
And it's tied to, you know, just basic understanding and absorption of cyber threat intelligence. If you know what attackers are potentially interested in, you could use that to help focus the techniques and TTPs that you particularly may be running into. And you could, you know, even focus your, you know, tabletop exercises based on those scenarios, which, you know, again, it doesn't take much to do a tabletop exercise just to see how people react, and, you know, provides invaluable, you know, gap analysis, you know. But even you could just tabletop with your own team, you know, if you're a tech leader, which is three or four people, you'd be able to say, okay, let's assume we get hit with ransomware. Who does what? And let's walk through this. And you'll find pretty quickly, you know, various opinions on what they're supposed to do, because, you know, unless you're hit with the daily, you know, you want to have those discussions early on, but then you realize you don't have the skill. What happens if it hit the server in the, you know, AWS or Azure environment? Do we even have access to, do we even know to call over there? You know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, those things can be really, really fun to do, right, in terms of tabletops, and then also very enlightening, whether it's tabletop or purple team test or whatever, right? Trying it out, practice makes perfect, train like you fight kind of mentality there. That's all stuff that works great for people who are in the industry, understand those things, and I think that's solid advice for anyone looking to do that kind of thing. What if you are not yet in cybersecurity and you are in whatever position you happen to be in and are looking towards it as like, oh, I want to make the jump.
Right.
what do you have as advice for them? That's a very broad question.
This could be its own episode because I'm actually very opinionated about this. So first of all, get in the field. There's zero wrong you're going to do for yourself. If you have an affinity toward computers and want a stable and yet fulfilling long-term career, then cybersecurity is something to really take advantage of. The second thing is, you know, to really take a look at, it's like, how do I get the prerequisite skills? And what do I need to do? And I would say initially, there's a lot of, you know, the technology-based courses that you could take, you know, A-plus certification. SANS has a security foundation. So I'm not, you know, trying to sell that. It's more of a take what you can. But then the next question I usually get, John, is should I go get a degree in this? And this is really a weird question because there's this, should I go get a comp sci degree? Should I get a cybersecurity degree? Do I need a degree? And you're not going to hurt yourself with to be honest, with, you know, going and getting a degree. The question is, if you had to say, what is the shortest path between A and B? I'm interested in cybersecurity. How do I get my first job? Is 2 to 3 training classes could honestly get you there. And then maybe look to a degree program that is potentially tied to those that you might be able to eventually get to, because, you know, long-term promotions, people like to see the degrees, you know, still the society we live in, but do you need to go get that 4-year education? You know, the question is maybe, maybe not. It really depends on what your life goals are. But I always get the question, it's like, I just want to get in the field. You know, I have a bachelor's degree, was in humanities or whatever. Not saying that's bad, but more of a, I want to go technical after my non-technical degree. What do I do? I don't want to have to go to another 4-year program. And that's why I said, you know, there are a lot of, you know, very core entry-level programs that are out there that unless you get employed and you're just lucky to be able to go through it. The other side is military, if it's an option, go on the cybersecurity track. I guarantee you they're going to give you a plethora of training. And you know, training and experience pretty damn quickly. But overall, it, you know, ties into that, honestly, most employers what the problem is on hiring these people, because they end up having, you know, the requisite skills. I'm hiring someone entry level, 3 years experience, you know, bachelor's degree in computer science, and, you know, 8 years experience in Kubernetes, you know, like that's the ongoing joke, but they overshoot from an HR perspective instead of saying, we will take you and train you, come work with us. And I actually am trying to advise a lot of employers to take this approach saying, if you sign up with us, we will get you the training. We need entry-level SOC analysts and we will train you to this job. It'll take 6 months, but we're going to invest into you. And you know, maybe there's a payback period, you know, or something like that the military does. I mean, there's different ways to approach it, but there's this aspect of, I'm telling employers, take the risk with zero experience and promise the training. And then you're going to get so many applications. You choose the best people for these, and you create an environment that has a rapid upward advancement out of those entry-level positions. And you continually do this. If you put to shoot too high, you're going to get no applicants because someone's going to take an entry-level job with 3 years experience. They're already at another level. But if you say we're going to train you, then you have your choice of 100 resumes. You choose the best one. And you might find a couple of comp sci degrees in there. It's like, hey, look, I found a comp sci degree. And, you know, passion, willingness to learn, and, those 2 things in addition to, I really want to be in this field. You measure someone on those 3 aspects, you choose the best of the resumes, train them yourselves. And that's what I'm trying to get the organizations to do. So it's an organizational problem, which ties into, I think, your 3rd question. But, you know, for someone who right now is like looking to get in the field, is like, try to take any class that's out there. But if you're an organization that wants to take a risk with the zero experience, we'll train you. Send me, you know, a tweet or something like that. I will gladly say, here's another organization willing to hire with 0 skills. Send your resumes in. They're hiring 10 people a month. I mean, you could imagine, you know, it's like, and then that HR group, but all you have to do is choose the best. Yeah. It's like the best internship program you potentially ever want, you know, but again, you have to pay them, but, you know, pay to train is a way to look at it. And I think a lot of organizations are just so scared of it that I'm looking at it from an aspect of invest in that early stage. It'll pay off. It's because that loyalty may get them to stay with you for a long time.
Hey, cybersecurity leaders and SOC managers. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know about SANS Management 551, building and leading security operations centers. It's a course made for anyone looking to build, improve, or be their most effective in leading a security operations team. But what I wanted to say was, since the release of Season 2 of Blueprint, we've had some exciting updates that I wanted to let you all know about. I'll start off by saying this. If there's one thing I've been surprised by this year, it's how quickly the new 5-day version of 551 has taken off with security ops team leaders around the world. We've seen continued rapid growth and interest in the course, no doubt given to probably the high rate of enormous damaging cyber attacks that have been happening over the last couple years. What you might not have heard is the good news that due to the popularity, GIAC immediately jumped on building a brand new security operations leadership certification to go with the course. So now, if you take Management 551, not only will you get 5 days of the standard SANS level of intense hands-on training with exercises, perhaps with Mark Orlando or myself as your instructor, but also a unique chance to be one of the first people in the whole world with the GIAC GSOM certification for security operations management. I'll tell you, this class is really, really fun. If you join us online or for one of our live classes, you're going to be taking the class with a peer group of security operations leaders from organizations all over the world and working with them on labs, facilitated discussions, and on our Cyber 42 exercise, which we run at the end of every day of the course. So this is a highly interactive and social course where you learn not just from the instructors, but also build your network of other security leaders who you can discuss your specific problems with and pick up best practices from as well. How cool is that? If you aren't sure if the course is for you, head on over to sans.org/MGT551, where you can check out the course syllabus and take a free demo section of the class. Thanks for checking it out and hope to see you online or at a conference in the near future. Now, back to Blueprint. I definitely want to chase that thread on the how do we pick out the best resumes. But before we transition into that, one other question on the person trying to get in perspective. Literally like an hour ago, I was in the Blue Team Discord channel and I get this question all the time. Someone's like trying to get my first SOC job, trying to break into cyber. There's so many options and niches. How can I test out which one is going to be the best for me kind of at that stage? Like, do you have any advice on finding your niche as best you can without having done the job yet?
you don't know. I mean, that's the hard part is, you know, get into the field and then slowly explore. You know, you may not like the defensive aspect or the incident response aspect. I mean, some of it is just like, you know, you start talking around to the lifestyle of an incident responder. You know, hey, I had, you know, tickets to go see a concert on Friday night. Well, guess what? You know, it's 4 p.m. on Friday. You get the call. You're not going to the concert that night. You know, that's the lifestyle. And so you know, then you're working 24 hours straight for the next, you know, 2 to 3 days, and it changed, you know, versus someone more on the defensive side, infrastructure, architecture. There's so many different fields in cybersecurity that, you know, the best thing is get in one and then initially like take classes that give you a little bit of everything and then start to say, I really actually enjoyed this. And then you start to focus in on that. It's almost like, you know, the same thing when you're in high school is like, what do you like doing? You know, do you like animals? Do you like, you know, the concept of being, you know, in the military? Do you like technology? Do you like debating? Do you like drama? And it kind of like, you know, if you like this kind of thing, you know, then there are fields out there that, you know, more focused for you. And I just don't think we're to the point yet where we're doing personality assessments, you know, which cybersecurity, you know, animal are you, you know, on Facebook or something like that. Maybe we should, but, you know, most people is you get the right mentor or someone that's working with you and you'll kind of just find your path. And I hate to say it, just get in the field and find your way. There's no assessment out there that's going to tell you are you really going to like it or not. People initially will switch fields and then get into, I really like this one. And then you become, you know, like become in depth at that one. It's really hard to become a technologist of jack of all trades at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of my advice to that person as well. As I said, like, you know, in the beginning, a lot of it is just get that first job. And once you get in there, maybe you can do some job rotations. You can talk to your coworkers. I said, you know, go to B-sides, talk to people in different organizations, whatever it is. Any InfoSec event you can get to where there's other people there, talk to them and see what they like and dislike about their positions. And then, you know, once you get that foot in the door, in my experience and what a lot of people say is like, you know, the second InfoSec job is way easier than the first one. It's that first one that's super difficult. But once you're on the inside, it'll be a lot easier to figure out what to do. And then, yeah, taking kind of broad training classes while you're there, you know, SANS related wise, 401, 501, stuff like that would be probably outstanding for a reskilling kind of broad spectrum. Here's a whole bunch of stuff from a whole bunch of topics, and you might like any of this stuff, right? And it will prep you to do a whole bunch of useful things while you're at it. Those kind of experiences and anything like that where you're going real broad can definitely help. Back to the organization trying to hire and do that reskilling. So let's say you got 100 resumes on your desk. You mentioned some of the things that you'd be looking for, right? Interest and passion and obviously a drive to learn and do this kind of thing. Are there any, I don't know if scientific is the word to put it, but more data-driven ways other than just kind of getting the feeling from talking to the person that you can use to try to identify the aptitude or likely potential for being awesome at cybersecurity from talking to those people, interviewing them, looking at resumes?
Yeah, actually, especially for entry level, you know, and I've, this is something, again, I've coached a lot of managers in technology fields in general about, because, and again, there's an overlap here between how are you going to get someone who's going to be willing to put the time in. You know, you kind of could tell, you know, initially is like, what do you do when you get home? And it's like, well, I never put my computer down. You know, my spouse, partner, my dog looks at me like, are you playing? Or are you working? It's like, I don't know. You know, there's this, I don't know, this may be playing. I don't, researching something. I guess it's playing. I can't, you know, like I've been accused of that. I'm sure you've been accused of that. It's like, oh, yeah. I honestly don't know if I'm, this is work or play. It's play. It's going to make it, you feel better. But, you know, let's assume they're not in technology in there, you know, at all here. So usually I try to find something that someone has attempted to master that's, you know, on their own. And again, this is a passion and willingness to learn, you know, whether or not, hey, I, you know, traveled over to Spain and, you know, learned Spanish, or at least, you know, I attempted to. Not great, but at least I was able to hang, and I met a, you know, really nice person over there. We're still friends, and, you know, we chat all the time, and I, you know, speak Spanish, and they make fun of me all the time because of it. Wait, you learned a foreign language. That's pretty hard, but you basically mastered the basics of that on your own. Yeah. Or what if they pick up golf or a new sport? You know, I you know, interview questions I usually prompt someone with is, you know, tell me a new skill that you've learned in the last 3 years that, you know, you're not the best at, but, you know, you would say in non-technical related that, you know, he gave it a really good shot at. You know, someone might bring up golf. He's like, yeah, I'm not really good, but I could do double bogey golf at this point. I like it, but I'd like to get better. You know, the fact that they stuck with it is what you're really looking for. You know, you're really trying to avoid those who need life and the challenges of life to be equivalent to an easy to understand as a TiVo remote, you know, where you look at it and like, okay, I can figure this out like in 3 seconds. You need someone to be able to say, okay, there's a point. It's the same thing that happens in exercise. And we've talked about this a little bit in some of our previous groups where the frustration builds and there's this kind of a nudge to say, you should stop. And then the person kind of ignores that and just presses on and says, well, you know, I know it's a little bit difficult, but I'm just going to continue because it's kind of, why would I give up now? I'm out here. I'm playing golf. I'm on hole number three. I'll just get. And, you know, or the same thing of like learning a foreign language. There's this aspect of doing anything out there that is brand new that you need to force yourself through that initial, yeah, I'm going to quit at this point. And that's really what you're trying to look for in the interview. And you could even ask the following questions. Did you ever want to quit? You know, are you still doing it? And really trying to measure their aptitude for, you know, picking up a challenge and forcing yourself to learn a new skill. Because if you find someone like that, you're never going to have to worry about them in your workplace. If there's a challenge in front of them, they're probably good to go self-teach themselves or get to a point where they're saying, hey, I know enough, but if you really need me to get good at this, I need to take a class. And that's really where, like, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people that have ended up being extremely good on Teams and they've had no business of being in cybersecurity when you initially interviewed them. But you could just tell, you're just like, this person is either just, you know, kind of like borderline crazy or I'm just gonna, you know, they're just, I want this. I will, you know, I'm going to dedicate myself to doing what is necessary to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And then they're usually, you know, you don't have people put that kind of passion down and have them be wrong. You know, I'll take a risk on you, see what happens. You know, but again, if you're looking for like, I need someone skilled and has all the check boxes, you might be disappointed rather than just taking someone with just pure energy and passion and just putting them in an environment next to a mentor that puts them on a hill that says, hey, there's a technology learning curve here. It's sink or swim, but I'm here to help. Just today, I want you to look at HTTP traffic and understand the initial 4 sequences of a GET request. That's it. master that, then we'll move to the next, you know, it's, you know, those are the kind of people that you fall in love with.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. When I was doing a lot of hiring, that was always what I was looking for, is like, you know, problem solving, the ability to push through very tough problems, and how they handled the tactics they used to get through that, if they hit some kind of roadblock or whatever it was, and just like the drive to do what you can do, right? From being an outsider in the industry. And when I was doing that myself, I made the jump from engineering into InfoSec. The things I was doing, you know, I was going to DEF CON, I was trying to do projects, you know, write a blog, whatever it was, right? Just so I had a little bit of extra head up on maybe someone that hadn't done those things, so I could show like, hey, I'm really into this. This is super interesting. Here's what I learned, whatever it is. That kind of stuff, I definitely think is a really good initial sign from someone who's going to be a candidate. If you were an organization, or maybe you've seen this before, whether you have, or this is just a what would you do question, as an organization trying to bring people in, maybe from their own employee pool and bring them into the SOC or SecOps team or whatever, where would you, or how would you structure a program to kind of help people make that transition?
Oh, that's, you know, it's another good question is, you know, into, you know, there's kind of like two forms of this question. It's like, you know, do you identify that folks, you know, let's assume there's two forms of the individuals, just brand new, like, hey, I'm working in, you know, field X and I want to be moved over to cybersecurity. I would do an internal cybersecurity scholarship program and announce positions saying, we need people and we would love to have you transition over, and, you know, make it an internal thing where it's an application process, just like an external job. But, you know, just saying, we're looking for candidates who've been with the company for 3 or 4 years, willing to go through the scholarship program, willing to, you know, and kind of make a big, you know, deal about it, you know, say, hey, upward momentum, you know, X, Y, and Z. The other side to that is, what if you have existing, you know, cybersecurity professionals on your team that you need to figure out, like, do they need to go through a retraining? Do they need additional skills? And this is, again, standard workforce mapping questions that so many people are so focused on the beginning of the funnel that they just assume that, and a lot of it's due to ego, is that you talk to the people out there who've been in, they've been our problem solvers forever. I've never had to worry about, you know, we call him the doctor because he's so good at what they do. Well, guess what? Lots of doctors really good at keeping their skills up to date. You know, you need to go back to them and saying, hey, listen, if you're going to choose 3 different training classes that we could send you to right now that would really help you, what would those be? And they'll know better than you. You know, that's, again, you could go to your, you know, long-term employees who are the doctor, you know, they're at the top of the food chain when it comes to technical knowledge, but I almost guarantee you, every single one of them will say, yeah, there's some stuff I would like to know, but they'll never fully admit it. I could brush up on some things, you know, but again, let them choose, and they'll probably choose something that they, you know, I'll say, really encourage you to choose something that out of these three is, because these are 3 problems. We have cloud, we have ransomware, we have, you know, attacker techniques, and we need to make sure that, you know, from your perspective, which one do you think would be most valuable for you? You know, we're going to send you out. And plus, you know, you could go recruit for us to do whatever, you know, you do with these, you know, cons. But that's the type of individual. You don't forget about the mid and upper tiers. Because right now, there's a 10-year gap between, I guarantee, ask them when they went to their last training class. And they say, well, I don't need, we need it for my team. They're almost like, a lot of them, the leaders, will say, no, I eat last. I need my team to be skilled because I need them. I need to rely on them. And that's where you need to say, well, we also need you, you know, the general, to maintain your hours in the fighter cockpit just as much as we have the lieutenant who's fresh out of fighter jet school to be flying those jets. I said, we need both of you. And that's where you need to take that time to really focus in on, you know, connecting with those individuals and saying, yeah, it's probably time. You need to go back. There's some gap here that we're missing that we're going to need your leadership on. And getting that gap is going to help identify the gaps in your lower tiers, because they're going to immediately recognize, this is really hard. I need help here. And it can't just be me, yeah, to worry about this. And that's where that gap filling is going to occur. And your workforce management really becomes your top of the top technical people that are going to help influence that the most. But they may not know what they don't know at this point. And that's where it's like, take that risk to sit down with them. If you're like the management side of this and saying, you need to go to training too once a year. Which one?
Yeah. Yeah, the knowing what you don't know or not knowing what you don't know problem is a big one. And really this whole discussion, especially with newcomers as well, is they're like, oh, should I focus on this tool, that tool, or whatever? So yeah, getting kind of guidance and mentors and anything that can help you kind of solve that, whether you're a manager or whether you're brand new to the field, is definitely a great way to try to focus your time and hit the right priorities. One of the things that reason I asked that previous question is, you know, I was in a group where we were reskilling people from like the network operations team. We were bringing people in from the endpoint team and having them train up and work in the SOC. And it worked great, right? We brought in people from completely other, you know, jobs that had nothing to do with IT. And we had kind of a set of classes and things that we'd have them do and benchmarks we had to have them hit kind of as an expectation for jumping into the group. And doing a little bit of research before we did this episode here, I was kind of Googling around to see if I could see if other companies have like a structured program. And I noticed like Booz Allen is one. They have like a program. I can't remember what they called it, but they bring people in and there's like a cohort where they'll all kind of go through the same classes together. And there's certain benchmarks you have to hit to be successful before you even get in to the job. I didn't know if you had any thoughts on, you know, doing it in that method versus individuals or any other ways of how you would structure getting people kind of to that level or testing whether they're ready.
Oh, great question. To be fair, I've not, you know, seen one way work better than another. Assessments are, you know, are very useful. The best assessment I've actually seen out there are those that, you know, like the recertifications and stuff like that, especially it's hands-on, but, you know, tabletop and seeing how the team reacts, you know, to basic fundamental, you know, here's this scenario. And usually have an outsider map it out, you know, the scenario development more that you possibly do. But, you know, in terms of like, you know, do we identify multiple gaps where it could send, you know, multiple people through a single training class? Some of that stuff is just like staring at the current technology set right now and saying, am I losing sleep over this? You know, that kind of gulp that occurs, you know, when you end up looking at how fast things have transitioned over the past 3 years in your enterprises. I almost guarantee right now, you know, you could throw a dart at the biggest Venn diagram and says, we need people in X. And usually right now it's, you know, cloud is probably the biggest one, you know, responding to cloud, you know, defending the cloud, cloud analytics is, you know, cloud, you know, sensors integrated in the SOC and host base, you know, it's like with their, you know, remote workforce, a lot of people still working from home. And I don't think that's going to change is, you know, do we have the right telemetry set up on these systems? And in addition to that, from a aspect of, you know, from an organizational standpoint, are we doing the basic security awareness programs for individuals as well? And again, something like, you know, having people focus in on just, you know, are we doing security awareness properly for a workforce? You know, when we have these incidents, it's usually attacking the human in one form or another. And, you know, we could save a lot of money. And I always, you know, tell organizations, like the amount you put into your training, you know, the risk is, you know, you put in a technology or you could pay out an insurance or you could pay out the ransom. So which one of these things might be cheaper? You know, again, it's a hedging your bets and putting, you know, some money in all of them. But, you know, what you look at the average cost of a single ransomware attack today is like, you know, $500,000, $1 million, you know, to a large organization. So that's, you know, would you have hired a couple more people, you know, top of the line, you know, trained a couple more people, maybe, you know, security awareness programs? You know, look at that. You know, it's like, you know, how often does the cost risk assessment, you know, when you're trying to, you know, weigh, should, you know, if you get hit, what, you know, what is the actual cost going to be involved? And then, of course, your insurance rates and everything are going to go up because, you know, X, Y, and Z, but it's the way the world we live in. It's just like, should you potentially take your car and for regular maintenance before it breaks down or, you know, hey, can I afford the breakdown? You know, it's, some people do it, you know, just like no matter what you say, I'm not changing my oil. I'm just going to wait until the engine dies and I'll take it in and I'll get it fixed.
Yeah.
there's logic here, but then there's also sometimes just experience of having to have a breakdown to realize, yeah, maybe I should have done it a different way.
Yeah, that's another conversation, you know, I've had as an employee and as manager and as an instructor with a lot of students in class. It's always like, how do I figure out what the right amount of training is and when to train and when not to train? And getting pushback on like, oh, we don't want to train people and have them leave and all of that. To the point where in one of the slides in 551, you know, I have the Richard Branson quote. I don't know if you've heard it, where he's like, train people well enough so that they can leave and then treat them well so they don't want to. right? And that's kind of my philosophy is like, you know, train people as much as you can because everyone wins when you're doing that. People like their job. There's a lot of data out there that shows, you know, people want to feel confident that they can do the job they're employed to do. Otherwise, that becomes, you know, stressful in a bad way that can lead to burnout. If you're always responsible for something, you're like worried you're on the edge of you know, competent for doing. And then, you know, making sure that the workplace is a place that people actually want to stay. That's kind of the recipe for success in my book. And, you know, looking at that, what I'm always trying to think about is, you know, and asking guests is like, how do we measure this? And you've kind of already answered that in some ways, right? You talk about tabletops and all that. Are there any, I don't know if it's management metrics or other kind of like numeric things that you would look for as a sign that I guess either reskilling is working or that you need reskilling or that your team is kind of on the right path for just doing all of this well and creating a good environment and of well-trained individuals?
Yes. The first metric you look at is what is your employee churn? And you know, how many of your employees are leaving? And is there a way we could get feedback on what needs to change to maintain them from not leaving? Is it a management issue? Is it upper mobility? Is it, you know, maybe it's even a training thing, but you know, wherever you're at, it's the question, you know, how fast can you run a mile? It doesn't really matter what that metric is. The question is, can we reduce it? Because of rehiring, retraining, and putting the person back into a position that's functioning takes months. And if you have consistent rotation, then you never will have a fully functioning team. And so for some of this is like, you know, organizations, well, we outsource a lot. We have a very small team for security people. But it's like, well, you lose one of them, and that could be a significant issue. So, you know, going back to them says, well, our, you know, churn rate is like near zero because they're all happy. I was like, but are they? You know, usually when you have a team of three people, guess what's going to happen? When one leaves, they all leave because they all like working together. So it's like, you know, hey, I got a job. And by the way, you two are coming with me. And then all of a sudden, what do you do? So the, you know, the question is when you have a really small team in an organization, medium-sized business, then, you know, definitely sit down at least once a year and just saying, you know, you guys okay? Are y'all okay? Or, you know, what do you need? You know, what else? And some of it is just as simple as like, you know what I'd like? Free books. You know, just I tell that to a lot of managers that just go and here's what you do. Just go and offer that team free books. Well, buy as many books as you want. Buy book. And I know you're like, really, that's crazy. I'm like, honestly, what is the cost? Are they really going to be spending $5,000 in books annually? Probably not. You know, and but again, who cares if they are? It's $5,000. You're like, well, that's a lot of money, but maybe that is enough to say, hey, listen, I like keeping myself, you know, on, you know, by keeping on various technology things by doing books. You know, same thing on the training side. Just like, you know, a lot of people in jobs see training as a benefit. And if you don't treat it as a benefit, just like PTO, people in technology fields hear about other workforces that have training as a benefit and they will seek that. They see maintaining and skill relevance as something that is to be maintained. And it doesn't really matter. It's like, and that's kind of the benefit side. There's the organizational needs and there's a personal need. And you almost need to sit there and, you know, say, how much do I let them just choose what they want to do? And maybe, you know, it's like a one for you, one for me type deal. It's like, you want your course, you have to take mine first. You know, it's like, I need someone who's really skilled cloud. Then you could go take your, you know, training course wherever, but I have to choose the city. You know, there's got to be a limit somewhere, but it, you know, they're just work with them. But usually I said, even two training courses a year, it's like one for you, one for me, is going to be able to maintain. It's like, wow, you know, you will get a lot of people like, you know, pass up on 30K, you know, plus job salary increases just because they like their training benefit. It's because they know they would always be able to leave and get that, but they like maintaining their congruence and ability to maintain their skill sets. But again, the biggest thing, metric, going back to your original question, is they just look, you know, if you're a large organization, what's your churn rate? And at the different levels too, entry, mid, top tier.
Yeah, I agree. Turnover is probably one of the biggest indicators of health of the team. That seems like it's universally, whether it's security or not, right? If people are constantly leaving, not a good sign. We're getting close to our end here. Any kind of final resources or other kind of things you'd like to point out that we can put in the show notes or any other kind of final thoughts to close it up?
Well, you know, it goes back to what I was saying before is, you know, my theory, and I'm starting to see this, is that, you know, really take a look at, you know, your cybersecurity workforce in general. And especially with what, you know, the the transition that happened during COVID and the rapid, you know, IT is one thing, but the IT security folks are completely different. They've been playing catch up for nearly 2 to 3 years now on this massive transition from, you know, everyone in a single office location connected by VPNs into everyone's working from home. And it completely transitioned that attack service. You should have a really serious conversation about, do we have the adequate skills, even for our senior most people, to defend and respond to incidents on our network. Then on the second side is those folks who are brand new, figure out a way to get them in the door. And like I said before, is, you know, saying, hey, we train. You know, it's one of those things, it's just, you can't beat that. You're going to have a lot of people apply and say, we will train you. Come on board with us. And we're going to mentor, we're going to train, show them the environment. And say, hey, every time we get a new group of five people, we're going to send you a training course. You'll go through the same training course. Then you'll work together as a team. I mean, there are different ways to approach it. But having HR kind of, you know, lasso around this 3 years experience, comp sci minimum, you're not going to find them. Those people are already mid-tier folks. You know, 2 to 3 years in, you're already probably a mid-level analyst. You know, it's like you're really trying to get them through that initial 1 year period and then have them stick with the team. But I recommend a lot of organizations take the risk on retraining, especially early on, and apply, get as many resumes in the door as possible and just choose the best and just cultivate the culture, you know, create the culture at that level to where they want to stay. And even if they do leave, you'll have some leave. That's the metric. It's like, can we get that metric higher? What additional changes can we have to be able to move them from a new to a mid-level security analyst on our team to where they'll stay with our team, like, 4 or 5 years. And that's kind of the other thing you got to look at is, what is the real expectation you'll have someone for their entire career? It's zero, folks, zero. You need to assume if you get someone for 4 or 5 years, you did good. Get off of the mindset that it's going to be like, I'm going to get someone for 15 years. Like, unlikely. Think 4 or 5 for those in their 20s right now. You know, and then if you're able to accomplish that, you did good. And then you just may have to hire in someone from the 5 year period. You're obviously taking from someone else too. But there's this inherent need, just the data does not lie, that most people in their 20s and early 30s are a 4 or 5 year max window per job that they're employed in. You know, just LinkedIn that, you'll see it all over the place.
All right. Well, I think that wraps it up. Thanks for all that. Awesome discussion. Had a good time. A lot of good wisdom in there for those looking to either reskill yourself or for those in your organization. So thank you, Rob, for joining us on Blueprint today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, John. Appreciate it.